A number of items were covered at last night's Borough Assembly meeting. Among them, Kevin Herron was finally sworn in for Assembly Seat A after an October 2nd municipal election that was followed by a runoff election that was followed by a recount that was certified last night. Herron was the incumbent who was challenged by a man who had left his own Assembly seat in an ultimately unsuccessful and sometimes nasty campaign to rid the Assembly of the man he referred to as a public menace. In other business, the Assembly voted to raise the borough mayor's salary from $45,000 to $48,000 per year, increased Assembly members' expense accounts, denied a request by the borough mayor for $6,000 for clerical support, passed a resolution supporting an interior gas conditioning plant, and another advocating state investment in an interior gas conditioning plant, voted to increase the price of bus tokens. They were 10 for $3.50, and now they'll be 10 for $4 even, and also approved a reduction in bus fares during non-peak hours to half fare. In addition to that mass of transit business, the Assembly also approved changing the name of the borough buses from Fairtrans to MAX, an acronym for Municipal Area Commuter Service. One other piece of business concerned the cleanup of Noise Slough, a narrow body of water that wends its way through much of town. Last year, the legislature had appropriated $100,000 to the city and an additional $50,000 to the borough to clean up and improve the slough, enabling canoeists and small boat owners to use the waterway. City Public Works personnel went up and down the slough picking up pieces of debris, and a 450-foot log jam was removed. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game had prohibited dredging or heavy equipment operation until after September 15th, so before proceeding with that operation, Lane Thompson of the City Public Works Department reported that he reviewed a 1975 Army Corps of Engineers report that recommended that the slough be made into three step ponds for the convenience of boaters. However, Thompson found that he didn't need department personnel to do that work.
But it turns out that because of the cleanup of the sewers that had gone into the slough is now full of beavers, and the beavers made five step ponds. And those, the step ponds that they've made in August, of course the beavers don't usually start damming until August, have greatly increased the usability, the navigability of the slough.
In this case, it looks like maybe it's beavers, not dogs, who are people's best friends. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. It has been reported on this program that the Wolf Country Foundation of Colorado had the official support and participation of muzzleloaders for their plan to trap wolves and transport them outside. Several members of the Fairbanks group of muzzleloaders were upset with the implication that they, as an organization, would be cooperating with the Colorado group. To find out just which muzzleloaders had offered their support, I called Wolf Country Foundation President Elizabeth Andrews in Boulder, Colorado.
There is a group, I think it's the Colorado Muzzleloaders Association. At any rate, they have befriended us and offered support for everything that we're doing.
Andrews acknowledged that she has not personally been in contact with muzzleloaders in Alaska and has not received support from muzzleloaders organizations in the state.
The people that I'm referring to are, they are muzzleloaders and they are buckskinners, but they will be using their expertise to personally help us. It's not in the form of an organization. It's just that they are members of an organization and they have befriended us.
John Nielsen is president of the Midnight Sun Moose Hiders and Muzzleloaders Association in Fairbanks. According to him, organization bylaws prohibit participation in potentially political activities, such as Andrew's wolf removal program.
Our bylaws state, and we were organized as a muzzleloading group several years ago, specifically exempted us from any type of political activity or endorsements of anything outside of the general realm of muzzleloading specifically, and we've tried to adhere to that all along in our functioning as an organization. And I do not anticipate at this time certainly any endorsement or participation by our organization in this proposal. There may be individual members, of course, who have their opinions on the matter, but as far as an organization goes, I foresee no such support.
Nielsen's group is one of five muzzleloading clubs in the state of Alaska, and there is a statewide organization of muzzleloading associations. I asked him if any of the five clubs were, to his knowledge, planning to assist the Wolf Country Foundation.
To my knowledge, at this point, No, I have not been informed by any of the other presidents of the Anchorage clubs or others of such an intent.
So it appears that individual muzzleloaders, if any, may assist Andrews, but there will be no organizational support for her plan, at least in Alaska. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. Picture, if you will, a series of Big Macs rolling along the road, down one highway, up a side street, coming to rest at the curb, and then continuing its cruising and stopping through town. That may be happening soon in Fairbanks, though the specter of a trail of mustard and ketchup and squished pickles isn't likely. Macs here aren't the type associated with the Golden Arches, but rather the term refers to buses, the Metropolitan Area Commuter Service, or Macs for short. The proposed name change for the local public transit system comes up before the Borough Assembly tonight, at which time the body can decide if they like the change from Fairtrans to Max. If accepted, locals will soon be barraged with an ad campaign and freshly painted buses, all intended to encourage riders to hop aboard the rolling Max. So says Transit Director Jim O'Sullivan. According to O'Sullivan, only 3/5 of current seats are being utilized, though that's a significant increase over past years.
In January of 1977, when we handled 4,200 people, in January 1979, we handled 33,400 people.
In 1976, when public transit was first introduced in Fairbanks, there were some clever radio and TV ads, but nothing has been done recently in the area of advertising to increase ridership. There was a consolidation of zones, making it cheaper to ride the bus. One zone now costs 50 cents, or 35 if one buys a token, which compares favorably with other bus systems nationally. But there are no plans to expand routes to more of the outlying areas north and west of town. Transit Director O'Sullivan has other priorities.
I think that before we expand the system, that I want to bring the utilization of the existing system up to a better ratio.
Ridership is higher in the winter when some people prefer to ride the bus rather than drive, but the linear development of the Fairbanks area works against the system. According to Larry Holmstrom of Alaska Video in Fairbanks, the firm who is handling the advertising account, the name Fairtrans didn't work for the public transit system either, said Holmstrom.
People didn't very frequently refer to the system here as Fairtrans, and a lot of people didn't even know what that meant. So we were just trying to come up with something that was short, hopefully catchy, and that would, in a very few syllables, conjure up in a person's mind what the commuter service is all about. So I was looking for a one-syllable word, and tossing around the various things that the bus system was, and decided that it was, in fact, a Metropolitan Area Commuter Service. That came out to MACS, and that spelled MAX, and it seemed like a natural, just like BART or some other service like it in other places.
Except that I think we're used to associating MAX with something else, with a kind of food. Are you trying to capitalize in any way on Big Macs and Little Macs and McDonald's?
No, I hadn't even thought of that.
Although Holmstrom maintains that he hasn't made the connection, it's pretty certain that lots of people will. Ron Howenstein, Borough Information Officer, admits he's thought of it, and it remains to be seen tonight what the Borough Assembly will think of it. The advertising contract cost $20,000 for a jingle that begins, "Hello, Max," Holmstrom refused to sing it for me and it hadn't come back from the production house in San Diego, and assorted video and radio spots. What happens if the Assembly doesn't like the idea and wants to scrap it? Simple. The Borough is out the bucks, and people will continue to ride on Fairtrans, a unique combination of Fairbanks and transportation, and they'll have to go out for the Big Macs. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.
In our district, a bilingual program is going to be provided and is provided for any student who comes from a background that is either linguistically unique or culturally unique to the typical middle-class white background that many of our school systems have been designed for.
That's Mary Claire Andrews, current director of the Bilingual Multicultural Program for the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District. I asked her to define what is meant by bilingual multicultural education.
Bilingual is defined by the state, can be any student who speaks another language and or understands another language to some degree. Many students, because of the fact that English has become so dominant in the state of Alaska, many students have lost their ability to speak the language but still retain a great deal of the understanding when their parents speak to them, their grandparents speak to them, many times like when they hear a story or even see objects that are named in the other language, they can point out which those objects
are. Okay, this means, you mean bilingual by virtue of home situation rather than external learning situation?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, mm-hmm. Now how about multicultural? Why multicultural rather than bicultural then?
We call it multicultural because our program isn't designed only for those students who do have the other language in their home. Our program hopefully is going to be a program for all the students in the district. Multicultural being putting in there because we want all the students to be able to take advantage of the rich background that the children in the class are bringing to school, be it Korean or Spanish or Native Alaskan or whatever, and we want to start being able to present these wonderful aspects of these other cultures right in the classroom and in the school environment as a whole, and not just restrict that emphasis to the students who have mm-hmm. the special backgrounds.
In Fairbanks, the largest numbers of students identified as bilingual speak or comprehend one of the 20 Alaska Native languages, with Inupiaq speakers, Northern Eskimo, comprising the largest group, followed by Spanish and Korean. Assessment and identification of the students is an important component of the program.
The state has some very rigid guidelines that we have to follow according to the identification procedures. First, we have to survey the home language usage, which we do by use of a parent questionnaire. Then we have to talk with the teachers and find out, are there any linguistic, I would say, differences that you're noting in the student's speech or in the student's ability to read or whatever. Once we get those two groundwork pieces of paperwork done, then we go in and do language dominance testing.
Now, what form does a questionnaire take? Is it sent home with the kid pinned to their shirt? How about the language dominance testing?
The parent questionnaire is sent home to every student in the entire district. Mm-hmm. Okay, that is a requirement. So is the language observation checklist that the teachers have to fill out. That goes home with a cover letter explaining to the parents the reason for doing this language assessment.
Now, how about if the parents themselves aren't fluent in English? How are they expected to understand these documents?
We send home all the documents also, especially the parent questionnaire, in the language other than English.
So you have, what, 10, 12, 15, 20?
Exactly. We got them all translated.
Andrews acknowledges that some parents are reluctant to admit that a child's dominant language may not be English.
They just are so worried about having their children be singled out as different. Mm-hmm. And they really want their child to be able to be assimilated as quickly as possible.
Now, you refer to fears of parents in terms of they want their child to be assimilated. Is that the goal of the program as well, to have the child assimilated into the dominant culture of the school system?
I would say no. And I would say definitely no. We have many, many goals. One of the goals is to produce proficient English speakers, or to help produce that, because we feel that the language of the school system right now here in Alaska is English, and we want those students to be able to have successful experiences in the classroom, and English is a prerequisite to that.
At this point, the bilingual multicultural program has not yet become integrated into the school system and still functions as an add-on. A materials center for teachers is being set up, unit plans and lesson materials on specific ethnic groups have been developed, and staff members are available to come into the classroom to work on special projects, as well as conducting regularly scheduled classes in some schools in the district. There are specialists, tutor aides, and so-called resource teachers, many of them bilingual, some with experience teaching English as a second language. Teaching English proficiency has thus far stressed verbal language rather than nonverbal aspects of inter-ethnic communication, though that may be addressed in the future, particularly as it pertains to the classroom teacher and their teaching style. Once a month, a grant-mandated Parent Community Advisory Committee meeting is scheduled to inform that group of the direction the program is taking and to solicit suggestions. The group, according to Andrews, was quite active last year as opposed to this school year. Meetings have been canceled, which could account for less attendance and interest, but she has hopes for increased parental involvement, possibly as cultural resource personnel. Though the bilingual multicultural program now functions during the school day, there are thoughts toward expanding into extracurricular activities.
We're going to be having a multicultural potluck. We hope to be having a lot more. We're toying around with the idea of a multicultural fair that would be district-wide. We're trying to think of some many different ways to involve this multicultural stuff in and out of the schools. We're also getting people together who can think of some extracurricular activities, especially that students who have been hesitant to participate in things that are already available, well, let's think of some alternatives. Let's think of some other things that the students may want to become involved with.
Given the reluctance of some school administrators and teachers to share their facilities and time with outside programs, increasing activities outside of school time may provide an avenue for insinuating the bilingual multicultural program and its goals of English language proficiency and multicultural appreciation into the regular school day. Though just what direction the year-old program may take remains to be seen. Andrews is leaving, and someone else will soon be responsible for coordinating the advisory committee, staff, and school personnel. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. Usually at this time of year, Fairbanks has around 20 inches of snow, but not now. Unlike previous winters, the total accumulation thus far is between 7 and 8 inches, and only 4 inches are still on the ground. The lack of snowfall affects cross-country skiing enthusiasts, dog mushers, trappers, clothing store owners, heating fuel distributors, and wild animals. According to Jeff Thompson, Weather Service specialist for the Weather Service office in Fairbanks, the basic cause of the low level of precipitation is
the circulation pattern of the systems, pressure, high pressure and low pressure systems. And basically, most of the precipitation has fallen south of the Alaska Range. The Alaska Range acts as a moisture barrier. And it's just, imagine the Rocky Mountains, for example, how moist it is on the eastern side of the Rockies. Colorado is a good example. The western side, Grand Junction, and that part of Colorado is extremely dry. What they call like the inland basin, the western basin. It's almost like a desert. And that's basically what the position Fairbanks is in. When you have a southerly flow, a lot of the moisture comes straight from the south. The Alaska Range acts like a moisture barrier.
But the Alaska Range isn't new to 1979. Why hasn't this happened in the past?
Well, it all depends where the moisture comes from. On certain years, a lot of the moisture comes from the southwest. And the Alaska Range sits to the south of us. It doesn't sit to the southwest. So a lot of moisture will come up to the Kuskokwim Valley.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the effects that a reduced snowfall would have?
Well, that's a good question. It could have a lot of effect. Insulation factor on the ground, for example. I have a garden at home. And on certain years when we have a lot of snowfall, I notice that the ground isn't so frozen underneath.
Mm-hmm.
It's still relatively unfrozen. But on years when we have very small amounts of snowfall, the freeze penetrates further in the ground. And of course, there's factors such as driving, for example, and snowfall removal.
Aside from slowly thawing gardens next spring and difficult driving conditions on slick roads for now, four-footed animals are particularly feeling the effects of the light snowfall. Some of them like it. Dave Johnson, a game biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, explains.
I think generally moose probably find it easier living now with snow levels down. Snow hardness affects moose because it makes it harder for them to walk, and snow depth obviously means that it requires more energy to get around because they've got to plow through the snow, and makes it harder to get at certain food items. Black bears and grizzly bears may be affected by a low snow level in the opposite way, interestingly, because they require a certain amount of insulation that snow requires, or that snow provides, rather, on a den, and also it provides kind of a door effect. They have a little hole that where they breathe in and out of, but the snow provides kind of a door. And although we're not really quite certain, it may have also, the lateness of the snow may have influenced some bears to spend more time out of the den. Fall is the time of year for bears when they're picking up their positive food resources, the berries and whatnot. And if they had stayed out later than the berries were available, berries are only available in large numbers through September. If they were out in October and November, then they may have actually been losing some of the reserves they've built up, and that could lead to mortality in some of the dens in spring.
Wolves are also affected by a light snowfall, in a way opposite from bears.
I think they probably have easier living at this time of the year because it's easier for them to get at their prey species. When the snow's deep, obviously they don't have great long legs like moose, so it's probably easier for them to catch moose and caribou and their prey species.
The department's wolf control program has also been affected by the snow, again in ways beneficial to the wolves. The department was unable to conduct a wolf hunt this fall, as they usually do, and it will probably be until late January or February that adequate snowfall will enable aerial wolf hunters to track the animals. The smaller animals, the type more likely hunted by the family cat, are also experiencing the effects of reduced snow cover.
Well, the animals that stay active all during the year, like some of these small rodents, I think this depth of snow to them is very important for living at that time of the year, and without it, they lose their insulating cover and they're open to the great heat sink of the sky, and they don't have, they're such high producers of heat, they need that insulation, and their little dams and things provide a certain amount of it, but they've got to move around, and whenever you're skiing or whatnot like that, you find little trails across your ski trails, and those are small animals like voles and lemmings and things, going from one snow tunnel out across this trail to another snow tunnel, and they spend most of it. Most all their winter under the snow, much warmer there.
Not only is it much warmer in a snow tunnel, it's also safer, away from natural wild predators and house cats. Although some light snow fell last night, giving hope to winter sports enthusiasts, trappers, moose, and rodents, it only added 1/10 of an inch to the meager total. For Fairbanks residents, it just may be a winter for canceling those reservations to Acapulco and stringing up that hammock in the backyard instead. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. Claire Fege is both a published writer and a much-exhibited artist. Her writing includes the books People of the Noatak, published in 1966, and Inuk, My Son, a children's book published in 1969. One of her poems, Alaska Song Cycle, was set to music and debuted at the Friends of Music Alaska Day concert last month in Fairbanks. That event coincided with the opening of a one-person show of her artwork, a large exhibit that included 17 watercolors, 15 oils, and one etching, some dating as far back as 1962, and others completed this year. Most of her work, regardless of when it was done, depicts scenes of village life. Massive forms bend over fish, sewing, or walking down a village street. The watercolors she does on site when visiting villages, but the oils are done in her studio in downtown Fairbanks. I asked Fej if there was a certain medium that she preferred to work in.
No, whatever happens, I can't do big oils in the villages, so most likely I'll draw or do a watercolor. And if it's not finished, I'll work on it when I get home.
You say that some of the work you do, like when you're traveling in a village, do you sometimes take photographs or use other means to remember things?
No, I very rarely take photographs for my work because I prefer to do it from memory or from a drawing that I've done on the spot. I don't work from photographs as such.
What kinds of subject matter particularly attracts you?
Well, I like to draw people the most. I like to, you see there's a few mountain landscapes here and a few icebergs, but mostly I like to draw people working.
Why is that?
It just interests me how they sit and bend, and that tells me a lot. And I like to draw the women, mostly the women. At work.
How do people react to seeing you do a drawing of them or of a friend?
Well, it's neat. They don't really give a damn. They don't care. Or they laugh. Mostly the reaction is to laugh. A lot of times I was the first artist they've ever seen, and it made it interesting for me. I would just be sitting there. They'd be doing their sewing, and I'm sitting on the floor doing my drawing. That's all. It's my work, and the sewing is their work. That's the way I look at it. It's my work.
How do you approach people to see if they'll be subjects for your work?
Well, if I'm sitting at a whale feast, I'm just drawing, maybe. Or if I'm living in somebody's home and somebody comes in, I'm just sitting there doing my work. It's just natural to me, like breathing. Or if I definitely make an effort to go to somebody's house, then I ask them if they would let me do it, of course. I always get permission, and either I pay them or do a trade.
For their sitting?
Absolutely. If they're working, and if I take them away from their work, then I have to pay them. There's no other. I'm pretty fair about that.
How do you select the colors that you use?
I make them up. I remember them. Do whatever my imagination. people think the Arctic is cold, and I think it isn't, because I see all the bright colors. The women are always wearing bright colored parkies, but I'm not very good at putting little patterns on things, so I make them a bright orange parkie or yellow, or they usually have prints on them, and I don't. That's not my technique.
You exhibit a lot of your work outside. How do people respond in, say, urban centers in the lower 48 to the work that you've done up here?
Yeah. Well, my show in New York City, the last one I had, they said it was the most amazing attendance. I had a lot of celebrities came, and I got good publicity in the New York Times and get on New York public television throughout the nation. I think there's a very good reaction, very gratifying to my work.
Do you think that because you choose subject matter that's unique to especially people, say, in New York, that they are particularly attracted because of that?
Well, I hate to think that. I think that if you're not a good artist, you're not going to get anybody to come to see it. It just happens that you have to have a good combination of good art, and I don't think it's primarily the subject matter at all.
Of course, it would be difficult to deny that recently people have been very interested in the North and may be more inclined to see a show of Northern subjects, quality of the artwork aside. From among her many depictions of village life, Fej has favorites. Here she describes one of them.
Well, I have a one painting about Barrow that I really like. It's two women bending over cutting a seal in the foreground, and it's in really hot colors. And the background shows a lot of the houses in the far-off distance. And I just feel like that represents Barrow to me. That's the way I feel about it.
But there was another painting in her recent show that she liked even better, another scene of Arctic life.
Well, the one I like the most is the one I call All of You. I love that. It shows two people walking down in the snow and the water in the background, and it's sort of a cloudy, stormy-looking look, and the little houses on both sides, and the people are burdened down carrying things. And it's the feeling of the whole village to me. It's hard, it's tough to live there, and yet they're walking jauntily along, and the houses have snow on them, and the whole feeling.
Many of Fej's paintings, whether of Barrow, Kotzebue, Point Hope, Stevens Village, or elsewhere, show women, sometimes engaged in subsistence activities, at other times sitting or doing housework, as in one painting of a woman washing dishes.
She's washing dishes, and she's pregnant, and I wanted to show how it is in a little crowded room with no water and the hot stove behind her. And it's a tiresome job. That's women's work. I'm trying to show how the women have to live and work, and they're the unsung heroines of the Arctic, and that's who I am trying to show in their faces and how they work and move. And that's my life work. To all my sisters way out there, hello.
Artist Claire Fej. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.